This is July 22nd, 2018, and I'm going to read from and comment on an article covering the latest sex scandal in Buddhism. Let's hope it's the latest. It was last week. I noticed in pulling this Taisho together that I gave a Taisho just last December about sex and power. But that was in response to all of the rash of sexual misconduct in the secular world of celebrities and athletes and businessmen and politicians. There was a especially thick bunch of them last fall related to the Me Too movement, which hopefully will be an ongoing thing. But this is what I want to talk about now is about the particular problem of misuse of sex, which really means power in this context, in the world of religion. So without saying too much more about it as an introduction, let me start in on this. This is the New York Times for July 11th, so 11 days ago. I saw it also in a couple of other online publications, but I'm going to go with good old New York Times because I think it's the best written up. So the name of the article is "The King of Shambhala Buddhism is Undone by Abuse Report." And this is by an Andy Newman. No identification of who he is. A reporter from the New York Times. So it starts off, in a shrine on the sixth floor of a Manhattan office building, a photo of a man in golden robes hangs above an altar. Another photo of him sits upon a throne. He is the head of one of the largest Buddhist organizations in the West, Shambhala International, a network of more than 200 outposts in over 30 countries where thousands come for training in meditation and mindfulness, and some delve into deeper mysteries. The man is Mipan Rinpoche. He is known as the Sakyong, a Tibetan word that translates roughly as king, and his students take vows to follow him that are binding across lifetimes. These days, they are feeling sad, confused, angry, and betrayed. Late last month, a former Shambhala teacher released a report alleging that the Sakyong had sexually abused and exploited some of his most devoted female followers for years. Women quoted in the report wrote of drunken groping and forcefully extracted sexual favors. The report said that senior leaders at Shambhala, an organization whose motto is "making enlightened society possible," knew of the Sakyong's misconduct and covered it up. Before we go further, I know that most people who are hearing this Taisho know very well how strongly the Rochester Zen Center and I stand about this abuse and how inappropriate, what a destructive thing it is, of teachers having sex with their students. But I felt that since this has made such a splash in the news, even mainstream publication like the New York Times, that it would be worth reiterating why this is so bad for teachers to be doing this, because I can imagine newer members of our Sangha and other Sanghas reading something like this, hearing about this, and just being afflicted by doubt and saying, what's the point of practicing if this can happen? So we're going to be clear here about how wrong this is. But to continue, the Sakyong apologized a few days before the report was formally released. That would have been about 3 weeks ago, admitting to, quote, relationships with women in the community, some of whom, quote, shared experiences of feeling harmed as a result. Followers and Shambhala groups around the world demanded more action. And would this demand for more action have happened without the Me Too movement last fall? Well, we don't know. On Friday, this more action came. The Governing Council of Shambhala International, which is based in Halifax, Nova Scotia, resigned en masse, quote, in the interest of beginning a healing process for our community. That's quite a strong move. The whole governing council of this international organization resigning. That night, the Sakyong, 55, took leave from running Shambhala as an outside firm investigates abuse allegations against him and other Shambhala teachers. He would, the announcement stated, enter a period of self-reflection. I have so many notes here. Let's see if we can start checking them off. It says somewhere in the article that all except one of these allegations happened before 2006, but the one that's considered credible after 2006 was pretty bad. We'll get to that. I'll keep reading. Skipping here to shorten this. The downfall of a Buddhist leader in the West accused of sexual impropriety has become its own sorry tradition. Last year, Lama Norla Rinpoche, who founded a monastery in Wappingers Falls, New York, retired after allegations of sexual misconduct. So did Sogyal Rinpoche, author of The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, who was accused of decades of sexual assaults and violent rage. In the Zen tradition, fallen masters include Joshu Sasaki and Edo Shimano, two of the leading proponents of Zen in America. These two I would put as the absolute worst of the Zen teachers who have been involved in sexual misconduct. He continues, in Shambhala, bad behavior runs in the bloodline. The organization was founded by the Sakyong's Tibet-born father, Chogyam Trungpa, a wildly charismatic man, brilliant teacher, and embodiment of the concept known as crazy wisdom, whose alcoholic exploits and womanizing were well known. He died in 1987. Just when I was beginning Zen practice, not just beginning, the first 15 years of Zen practice, he was the guy. Don't have time to go too much into him, but he was really just inveterate. Alcoholic abuser of his female students. So here we've come into one of the problems here is that This is his son. This article is about this so-called Sakyong. And that's one of the vulnerabilities of any bloodline, is the merit is not necessarily the biggest part of it. It's the same in Japan now, where typically a Zen teacher will leave the temple to his son. And the son may have no particular credentials or understanding, no particular wisdom or compassion, but it's become a bloodline. This is the big argument, one of the big arguments for monasticism, is that you're not going to fall prey to that inheritance, blood inheritance. Being the head of a temple in Japan is, at least until maybe fairly recently, has been seen as a great sign of prestige. And what father wouldn't want his son to inherit the temple and carry on the family name? But you can see what kind of deterioration of standards that could lead to. Well, in Tibetan Buddhism, at least in this case, in Shambhala, did this guy deserve? Did he deserve to inherit the throne, literally the throne, from his father, the notorious Chogyam Trungpa? Trungpa, yeah, this phrase, crazy wisdom, is one that he came up with. By the way, I have to full disclosure, I think his writings, Trungpa's writings, are really quite brilliant in places. And I've even quoted from his writings in Taisho. But he had this weakness, to put it mildly. Now we see his son too. There's someone, I can't remember who said this, but regarding one's own weaknesses and to what extent you can descendant can be free of those weaknesses. Someone said, can the land crab teach its young to walk in a straight line? Question mark. And this, I have to say, is also kind of lineage affliction, this affliction that carries on through generations of one lineage, also happens in Zen. There is this Zen teacher who died, I don't know, 30 years ago or so, by the name of Maizumi. And from what I hear, his Dharma heirs and their Dharma heirs, there are more of them involved who've been fallen because of sexual misconduct than in any other of the lineages. He also has some very impressive people in his lineage, has to be said. So Trungpa died in 1987, and then between him and his son, the guy of the article today, Shambhala was led by an American-born Buddhist who is mainly remembered for having sex with students even after he knew that he had AIDS. How about that? I will forever be embarrassed by these kinds of stories, but I do think it's better that we be transparent about them and acknowledge them rather than not. The article continues, "The hyper-concentration of authority in the most revered teachers of Tibetan Buddhism lends itself to abuse," said Lama Tsultrim Alyon, one of the first American women to be ordained a Tibetan Buddhist nun, and a former member of Chogyam Trungpa's group who knew the Sakyong when he was a child. Very prominent disciple of Trungpa is Pema Chodron. I think many of you know the name Pema Chodron. I think she's a wonderful teacher. I mean, just based on, I've never met her, but based on her books, and I think you can't go wrong reading the teachings of Pema Chodron. But I have to say, I've never heard her acknowledge the abuses of her teacher, Trungpa. This Tsultrim Alion said, "One is told that one must see the Lama as the Buddha, and that anything the Lama does is perfect, and that whatever might seem wrong with it, that is your impure vision. This can be a transformative practice, but only when the Lama is truly awake," she said. She leads a Buddhist center in Colorado and just published a book, Wisdom Rising, Journey into the Mandala of the Empowered Feminine. Another little anecdote that springs to mind, when we were discussing this matter of teacher sexual misconduct, one of Maizumi's disciples said, "Well, what about Trungpa? I think he was defending sexual misconduct and or defining it differently." And eventually was run out of Bar Harbor, where he had a center, because of his habitual sexual misconduct. But he said, "Oh, what about Trungpa? Trungpa was open about it. I think it's, if you're open about it, then it's okay." Well, I don't. He was open about it. But the problem is, that's one problem is the secrecy. And another disclosure here that many of you know already, one of my own Dharma heirs, I had to accept his resignation when, as the leader of the one of our affiliates in Chicago Zen Center, he called me and admitted that for a year and a half he had had a secret romance with one of his students. Now, this was not the most egregious case I've heard of. He was not married at the time, and neither was she. But with him, I have to say, his wife, their divorce was pretty abrupt, and she said it came completely out of the blue. So the timing of it was a little bit questionable. But anyway, he was not officially married when he took up with this student of his. And he kept this going for about a year and a half without letting me know or anybody know. And so when it finally came out, he called me right away and acknowledged it and offered his resignation. And I think to his amazement, I accepted his resignation. I think it's the first time I've ever heard Sevan silent when I said, "Yeah." So that was a consensual sexual relationship, teacher and student, but it doesn't matter. It can't be a wholesome relationship if with that power differential. The teacher holds all the cards. The teacher has this position of power. Just, it's the nature of teaching. It's like a psychotherapist or a school teacher. It's just not healthy to get sexually involved with a student. So she was all for it. Yeah, and that's part of what goes on here is the power as aphrodisiac. We see it over and over and over again. It's sort of the nature of male-female relationships. I went back and reviewed some of my notes from a Teisho about the book by Helen Fisher, the Anatomy of Love, in which she looks about the innate aspects of sex, that is, our hardwiring in the matter of sex, those traits and tendencies we inherit from our past, sort of genetic things. One of the things she cites in her research is the tendency of men to spread our seed and of women to want to find security through powerful men. This is old stuff. This is primitive stuff, none of which we have to succumb to, male or female, but these are tendencies. We're wired in these ways. Women in spiritual practice, it's not so unusual for them to kind of fall in love with the teacher. It just sort of goes with the territory. I've been relieved to find that since having gotten married 27 years ago, that's not something I've had to deal with. But before that, there were about 5 years when I was the abbot here and teacher, where I did have to deal with those things, and it takes a lot of clarity and strength to recognize that it's not oneself so much as it is the position. The best thing a teacher can do is find, if a teacher has the need to mate, if he's single, let's say, then he needs to find someone not in his own sangha, which is hard. I can testify to that. If you're consumed with managing a sangha, especially one of this size, you're pretty much everyone you know is in the sangha, and it takes quite an effort to even find someone outside the sangha. But we see here what kind of damage can be done if you don't, and it's kind of a lazy thing too to just pluck people, students of yours, to get involved with. My wife said many years ago, she said, these guys, sure, they just find these students who look at them with adoration, and that's, anyone can do that. It's, they're just so lazy, they can't go out and get someone outside of their sangha. And then there are the social problems that ensue from a teacher getting sexually involved with his students. When I was in Japan, 33 years ago, I was talking about this whole matter with the assistant to the Roshi at Sogenji. Her name is Chisan. She's now herself a Roshi. But at the time, she said, and look at it from the woman's point of view, okay, my teacher is sexually involved with this other woman, or these other women. Usually it's more than one. She says, and this is really to her credit that she was so frank about it, she says, I would think, what's wrong with me? This is very insightful on her part. Instead of just seeing women as just pure victims, seeing that there is, you would think almost always, or maybe always, some ambition may be too strong a word on the part of the women, but some kind of longing for that to be that kind of partner to someone in such a position of power. And especially in Tibetan Buddhism, even more than Zen Buddhism, because they had this whole monarchy model, which we'll hear more about now. In Shambhala, the level of institutionalized hierarchy is quite extraordinary. This is still this Lama Tsultrum, this woman. With the Sakyong functioning, and these are her words, sort of like a divine king, his inner circle, with its ministers and attendants, is called the court. He has a personal flag that local centers can buy for $350 to fly when he visits. Well, all right, in Tibet, that may be perfectly normal and acceptable. And Tibetans know how to manage that kind of reverence, almost deification of a teacher. But when you bring that, you try to transplant that into this culture, is where things can get crazy. Continuing here, the woman behind the expose, so this, remember, this article came out of this expose by an Andrea Wynn, grew up in the Shambhala community in Halifax and says that she and many other children were sexually abused by adults in the community. In early 2017, months before the Me Too became a cultural phenomenon, she began a year-long effort, Project Sunshine, to gather accounts by survivors of the abuse. The resulting report, published in February, I guess this maybe this past February, prompted Shambhala International to announce, quote, an effort to address issues of past harm in our community. I have to say I'd be surprised if this Sakyong has been a good boy since that last reported incident in 2011, but let's hope he has been. The Sakyong praised survivors for bravery and courage in speaking out without mentioning any misconduct of its own. But the report also prompted women who said they had been abused by the Sakyong to come forward, providing material for the second report, released June 28th, so that was just about 3 weeks ago. One woman wrote that for years before he was married, the Sakyong would kiss and grope her when he got drunk. By the way, drunkenness and sexual misconduct often go together. Like many women in sanghas as well as out there in the world, like many women around the Sakyong, she desperately hoped to become his wife, she wrote. And she rationalized his boorishness by telling herself that the Sakyong was trying to show her, quote, the patterns of my own poverty mentally, the patterns of my own poverty mentality and grasping. So, good for her, she's owning her part of this, you know, it takes two to tango. But she let him off the hook way too much. Another woman wrote that the Sakyong summoned her one night, and when she refused to have sex with him, he pushed her face toward his penis and said, "You might as well finish this." She wrote, "I was so embarrassed and horrified, I did it." A third woman wrote that the Sakyong groped her in 2011 after his daughter's first birthday party. About that, she was so embarrassed and horrified, I did it. I touched on this in the Taisho last December, but there is when people raise questions about the why the woman didn't come out with these things sooner, there are good reasons for that, psychological reasons. They're stunned, they're confused. But we won't review those things. And yet another woman came forward on Tuesday, I guess that would have been last Tuesday, and said that at a dinner in Chile in 2002, a drunken Sakyong pulled her into the bathroom and locked and blocked the door. He started to grope me and try to undress me, she said, by phone, speaking on the condition of anonymity. I was like, no, no, I have a boyfriend. He said, it doesn't matter. She said the Sakyong grabbed her hand and put it on his penis. Blah, blah, blah. Okay. So yes, it says here, with the exception of the 2011 episode, the allegations against him date from before 2006. And now they have an outside independent investigator they've hired, who said that all the accounts appear to be credible. She found all the accounts credible. And then the end of the article, many of the Sakyong's followers are praying for him. Certain member of the Sangha there said that when he sees the Sakyong's photo above the altar, he thinks about the pain the Sakyong must have been in that would have led him to cause such harm to others. And then the final sentence, they quote him as saying, with every breath I exhale, I hope that some of my mercy is communicated to him. Well, that's also a healthy thing. It's you have to acknowledge the pain that such abuse comes out of, for sure. Healthy people don't abuse others that way. And we must never lose that aspect of it. There's a place for compassion when someone does this, but compassion balanced with some kind of remedial measures. Before I got married, female students, not that there were so many, but the female students would acknowledge that they, or not, just without even spelling it out, I could see that they were wanting to get involved with me, I would say what is true. I would say, it's not me. I think you're in a period of romancing the Dharma. You're falling in love with the Dharma, and as a teacher, I represent the Dharma, and so it's getting conflated. You're seeing me as the Dharma, and that's the problem. And usually that seemed to help. Then they would just thank me, and that'd be the end of the matter. Among the notes I was scanning for this Teisho was from an interview I did with a Sangha member who worked as a dancer in a club, and she long time ago, and she understood, to her credit, that everyone there in those clubs were trying to satiate a deep hunger for love and intimacy. This too is important to have us never lose sight of this. And any kind of sexual craving really is underneath it. At its root is the longing for wholeness, for merging, for oneness, for intimacy. No matter how deplorable the activities, no matter how inveterate the transgressions, there's a deep need underneath it. After all, these guys are Buddhas. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. So there's just something malformed or wounded, and we have to keep that in mind. She said, from her experience working one of these clubs, strip clubs or whatever, I don't know, she said, those on the floor as well as those in the dressing room upstairs, neither the customers nor the girls ever got what they unconsciously went to the club for. And this is a matter of opportunity. The biggest factor, and this is a lot of sources will say this, the biggest factor in extramarital affairs is opportunity, or just more generally, situational factors. Opportunity, for example, travel, social networks these days. It's how people vary in accessibility and desirability to others. The workplace is the great benefactor. That's where the opportunity is strongest. And for these teachers, these rogue teachers, the so-called workplace is the sangha. I have a little bit here from Roshi Kapo. In the mid-70s, he was conducting a workshop in Toronto, York University, before a packed auditorium. In those days, there were only two or three Zen teachers in the United States and North America, so the auditoriums were always packed. And it says here, the question and answer period was polite in the Canadian manner, until a young man asked, "Roshi, when was the last time you had a sexual fantasy?" Okay, now I got your attention. Roshi replied, "Oh, about an hour ago, when this beautiful Chinese woman got on the elevator with us." It says here, "That brought the house down." The man raised his hand again, and Roshi called on him again. The man asked, "Did you act on it?" Roshi said, "There is a time when I might have. Now, they are like uninvited guests," that is, these desires. "They are like uninvited guests. I neither pay attention to them, nor to try to make them leave. Before long, they leave of their own accord." That's the thing that you would hope anyone who's in a position of authority in spiritual practice, anyone with experience, they would know, is that desires pass. Desires pass. They all pass. Everything passes. And if you can just hold strong until the desire passes, then you save a lot of suffering. First and foremost to the student, and then also to yourself. Now, I want to read the letter that just came out 11 days ago from this Sakyong Mipam. This is from a online magazine called Mindfulness. So this is his letter. It's a good one. Let's hope he means everything that's said here. To the Shambhala community, in a state of complete heartbreak, I write to you, humble, embarrassed, and thoroughly apologetic for disappointing you. I feel a tremendous amount of sorrow for the pain, confusion, and anger that our Sangha is experiencing. I accept accountability for this pain and want to express my commitment to personal growth. I fully support a third-party investigator being hired to look into claims of sexual misconduct in the community. I feel that I must, at this time, step back from my administrative and teaching responsibilities as a leader of Shambhala to allow space for the investigation to occur. It is clear to me that I have much learning to do. I am committed to engaging with women and others in our community who have felt marginalized beginning this week. I will be using this time of self-reflection to deeply listen and to better understand how the dynamics of power, gender, and my actions have affected others. I know that some of what you are hearing may be surprising and shocking for those of you who have only known me as a teacher. I wish to share with all of you some of the challenges that I've gone through. None of this is to give an excuse for my actions, but I do wish to be open with you about my journey as a human and give some history and context to my life and behavior. After the passing of my father, I took on the leadership role of Shambhala at a young age, followed by my enthronement in 1995. See, he's 55 now, so he was enthroned, John, in 1995.
He's early 30s, I guess.
Okay, that's good enough. During this period, I struggled to find my way and fumbled with unhealthy power dynamics and alcohol. I failed to recognize the pain and confusion I was creating. Early 30s. So you got a lot more to work with, work against. It's an uphill. The younger you are, the more of a headwind you have in these matters sexual attraction. I took over the center when I was 38, and I'm reminded of what Roshi said when he was much older. He said, he was one of, Roshi Kaplow was one of the only two, I think, first-generation teachers who weren't implicated in sexual misconduct with their students, and he said that this was in his 70s, maybe. Let's make it the 70s. He said, it's really, at my age, it's not really that impressive that I can steer clear of women, but he wasn't always that age. He took over the center here when he was much younger. What was he? 1912?
54?
He was 54, yeah. But another disclosure, when I took over when I was 38 and this was 5 years before I was married, I had a couple of close calls myself with my students. And as I read on here, you can maybe have some understanding of what's going on. He continues, in the years following this feedback, I cut back my drinking, began running and developed a more healthy lifestyle physically and spiritually. I committed myself to deepening my own practice and teaching path. In 2005, so that's 10 years into the job, I met and married my wife, the Sakyong Wangmo. We established our home, began a family together. She has been a teacher and partner, helping me to open my heart in a healthy way. So that was about the time that these reports stopped about him being sexually involved with his students. I can't help but wonder whether he was encouraged to marry her. It helps to be married. Well, you know what really helps is to be crazy in love with your wife. That's what really helps. He continues, since then, I have consciously worked on improving my relationship to alcohol, as well as trying to improve my general behavior and my relationship to others as a teacher and as a person. Personal development and learning is a lifelong process, and I know that I must continuously apply myself and hear the feedback that I am getting. I feel tremendous regret and sadness, and I commit myself to continuing this healing. Our teachings advise that we do not give up on ourselves or on each other. I am realizing that I have much to learn and am committed to that process. I hope that by my doing this, our Shambhala community and organization can evolve and become a true place of kindness, respect, and dignity. I am here for you, and I'm thinking of you always with love. Sakyong Nipon Rinpoche. This is the kind of letter that I was waiting for from Savan Ross after this year and a half of secret involvement with the student. Some statement of regret, of the resolution to want to work through this, but never got it. And haven't tried to maintain a communication, a correspondence with him since then, because the last thing we want to do is leave people feeling shunned by the community. But after just a couple of months, I was getting no responses to my letters, and haven't really heard from him in years. One last thing. This is our own, the part of culture in this. You know, I mentioned Tibetan culture, where they have this sort of spiritual monarchy has become normal, and they've learned to work with it. Well, our own culture has its own tendencies that would have been part of these things. Not just this one scandal, but the many that have happened among Buddhist teachers, Zen Buddhist and Tibetan Buddhist. And this is based on something that happened in 2011 with a guy by the name of Greg Mortensen, who became lionized after he wrote a book about working with Afghanis. He was put on a pedestal, it turned out that his lot of it was fabricated, and that was that. But the author here says, this is Hampton Sides, says, Americans have a profound longing for heroes. Now, perhaps more than ever, we need our explorers, our sports icons, our Medal of Freedom winners, our Nobel laureates. We need our greatest generation warriors, our Sully Sullenbergs, Burgers, our Neil Armstrongs. On some level, we still subscribe to the myth of the man in the white hat. We yearn to believe not only in his good deeds, but in his inherent goodness as a person. Perhaps it's something rooted in our Puritan past, but we seem to have a monochromatic view of heroism. We have a hard time believing that the doer of a heroic deed could have serious defects or even be rotten to the core. Heroes are supposed to be heroic, period. Yet all heroes and saints are imperfect, even the greatest ones. Mother Teresa, Mortensen's professed role model when he was growing up, was widely criticized for the deplorable condition of her clinics and for accepting large sums of money from mafia dons and third world dictators. Martin Luther King Jr. plagiarized parts of his PhD thesis and engaged in marital infidelities. Gandhi had a decidedly weird habit of sleeping beside naked young women to test his vow of celibacy. Que hombre. Just last couple sentences. I hope that I haven't come across as too judgmental of this Sakyong. We have to be clear that this kind of behavior causes damage. It causes harm. You can be clear about that. While still trying to understand it, and of course demanding that change happen. Our time is more than up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha.